Hello and welcome to Towards the Point, a cultural compass for Pompey and beyond. I'm James Sandy, and in this show we assess the changing state of play in the long battle between digital and analogue music with the help of Neil Young and Record Store Day 2014. We speak to Janet Ayres about her growing musical portfolio and the role of authenticity in the music industry. And we get suited and booted for a new religion via a compelling new book on the 60s mod scene in the UK. Joining me as ever is the man whose knowledge of it all gives Wikipedia a run for its money, a guardian of the great cultural temple, a garish swatch in the Taylor's catalogue of style, it's Dave Allen.
God bless you, sir. Thank you.
And we're going to start tonight with that infamous battle, analogue versus digital. It's a lot more than that, I think it's fair to say. Neil Young's a key character in this, and we're going to talk about his recent audio offering very shortly. But first of all, we're going to talk about something called Pono. Basically, it's a new media player, a new audio player, which is designed to give high-quality downloads. It's been developed by Neil Young, and it's going to launch across the world in October of this year. And for the techies out there, just to give you, just to whet your appetites, it's going to be high resolution audio, 24 bit at 192 kilohertz. That doesn't mean a great deal to me, but the idea is it's high quality sound. Neil Young himself says that what he wants to do, what he wants to achieve by this project, is present songs as they first sound during recording sessions. That is a bit of a tall order, I think. He has raised so far $6.2 million via the crowdfunding website Kickstarter, so he's had a lot of backing. But a lot of there's a lot of scepticism about this as to whether we need this and whether we need another device. And I think we'll probably start the debate, Dave, with the kind of quality of sound versus quality of experience.
It's a good juxtaposition, and I know nothing about what this is going to sound like, and I think I'd like to say right at the start that I have no problem at all with things sounding as good as they can. If I just think about my life's experience since I first bought records, which takes me back well over 50 years, and I remember being at home when my dad, who was clever with these things, took our 78 RPM record player and bought enough stuff to turn it into a 33-45. So I started buying pop records in 59 or 60. But it was on an old speaker, you know. And then there were those little Dansette things through the 60s and so on. And transistor radios, you'd sit on the beach and listen to pirate radio on transistor radio. And something would come on and it would be just a great song and you'd love it. But an awful lot of those experiences are qualitative experiences. They're to do with where you are when you're listening to it and how you're feeling about it and so on. They're not necessarily qualitative experiences in terms of the quality of the recorded sound. The other thing to say about it is I've been in a lot of recording studios. I've done a lot of recording and I've quite often been frustrated by the sound that's come out that doesn't seem to me like the sound that the band I'm in makes. It sounds okay. The question for me then is that the job of a recording studio, or is the job of a recording studio to construct something that is actually quite significantly different from a live experience? It's not a live experience, particularly now with multi-tracking. You're actually constructing something different. It's kind of like the difference between a quick sketch in pencil and an oil painting. The media are different. The result in product is different. So fundamentally, I don't have any objection to the idea that people try to come up with systems that are better than they used to be. But given the amount of music I've made and listened to in my life, I've never got terribly agitated or upset about new systems. You know, I still buy and play vinyl, but, you know, I also sit working at my computer playing iTunes through a tinny little speaker, and it frankly don't bother me. I think there's a point beyond which you have to stop being too kind of anally retentive about the whole thing.
There's a parallel of this in the kind of slow food movement, which was, you know, kind of big, I suppose in the 90s really, and still kind of big in some countries now, where, you know, it's an indulgence, it's a luxury, you kind of immerse yourself in this rich super product. Whether the product's actually any different or not is a key question, is it? A number of people who sort of criticised the Pono player have said that, you know, are these issues of consumption, i.e. people believing they're listening to the best or the highest quality, or are they issues in terms of the engineering and the mastering of the music itself? Maybe it's not about the format or about the player, it's about actually what changes once, you know, the production process starts?
Yeah, I think that question of is it about consumption, I don't necessarily doubt the integrity of somebody like Neil Young, but he isn't going to do this single-handed. And there is no question, is there, that the record industries have got either excited by or panicked by new formats throughout history. 78 to 45, 33, brilliant. You know, the sooner we can get moving that, brilliant. 45 and 33, I remember things like 8-track cartridge, you know. I remember in the home video movement, Betamax, which was the best home video system. It just died a death. You know?
Laserdisc and the digital and so cassette and the mini disc, all those kind of things.
And they panicked like mad, didn't they, about iTunes and Napster and online and all the rest of it, because they thought they were going to lose money. It was nothing to do with integrity or authenticity. It was, we ain't going to make as much money as we used to, you know, and I have a kind of limit, you know. I mean, as somebody who once signed a recording contract which promised me penny apeny for every record sold or something and never got a penny. I mean, I should have got at least £5, six and threepence out of it and didn't, you know. I have a limited sympathy to the moguls of the media industries. But it is difficult because you do want to balance that against the fact that I don't want to come home with a record that jumps or isn't very well... A perfect example for me is the wonderful Smokey Robinson, the Miracles song, Tracks of My Tears. I remember buying that on a CD, and I already had it and all sorts of other... And it seemed somewhere in the distance. I was straining to hear it. And I went back to the single, which was the first version I ever bought of it, and it was and recorded that, probably in those days, on a cassette. And it was the loudest recorded single I've ever heard in my life. It kept going into red, and I have to turn it down. The power in this 7-inch single was enormous, and somehow by the time it had got on the CD, they'd lost it. Well, that was awful, you know, terrible. But I'd rather listen to good music on crap systems than crap music on good systems.
But there's definitely something to that. And I think there's a number of questions about, you know, are we at a stage where we need yet another device and yet another format? You know, the idea of the Pono player is that it will play any format, you know, from now, retrospectively, and you know, and anything that's coming up in the future. But the question is, do we need that? And as you've said, you know, kind of, can we detect the subtle differences in terms of our own ears, you know, do we need to? You know, that there's a question there.
I wonder about we as well, because, you know, you're significantly younger than me, but you're a real consumer of music. Now, I've got a feeling that my generation, I'm mid-60s, you know, we've been through 78, 33, 45, all those things I just reeled off, you know. We kept adapting. We sold our record collection and bought CDs. Then we got into iTunes, you know, and I've got thousands of tracks on iTunes, and I'm now buying vinyl again at places like Pine Vinyl. But I am not going to go for any more systems in my life. You know, they will outlive me and so on. But maybe if you're 25 or 30, or, you know, the guys at Pine Vinyl tell me that when the younger people, when the students go in there, they almost feel like they have discovered a new medium, a new system called vinyl, called record players. Wow. Which I think is lovely. I think it's quite delightful that they've constructed that mythology around it. So maybe they will, because they'll see it as 40 years worth of investment. But I ain't going for any more systems. I got enough, really.
Loud and clear there, I think, from Dave. But that moves us nicely to the next Neil Young project that we're going to talk about. And now he's released a record only in the last couple of weeks called A Letter Home. Now, it's a very interesting release, and it's been described as a art project, and as such it's had quite mixed reviews, I think. But the basic premise of the record is that he has recorded a number of, I think, fairly personal songs that he calls his musical roots, cover versions to you and I, in a 1947 Voicegram, which is a bit like a phone box, but allows you to go in, do a speech, a poem, or a song, or something like that, for a couple of dollars, and it would give you actually a physical vinyl recording. Now, this Voicegram is slightly special because it's been lovingly restored by Jack White, who's produced the record at Third Man Records, which is his record studio in Nashville, Tennessee, nonetheless. Now, basically, this is a rudimentary, because of the time it was built, recording device, one microphone in a phone box, if you like, and it records it straight to a master, straight to the acetate. Neil Young has said himself that this is one of the lowest tech experiences I've ever had, which is interesting when you place that against what we've just been talking about in terms of creating the next digital machine, the pure audio machine. But it's a really interesting record. I listened to it and thought, I'm not really sure about this. I listened to it on vinyl. I bought it on vinyl, as I think they intend you to. And you listen to it and you think, well, this is a bit shaky, a bit scratchy, but there's something there's something really kind of magical about it. It's almost like you're listening to a radio station from 100 years ago and you're picking up kind of Neil Young sort of time travelling. It's a real, mm-hmm. real listening experience.
I think you're right. I think if what you hear, you know, the diet of music on mainstream radio programmes nowadays is almost constant in terms of its production values. So when you hear something that jerks you out of that, it forces you to rethink. And, you know, you might be inclined initially to dismiss it or overpraise it, I think, is a possibility for those reasons. And I think it does that really nicely. I mean, there are three stories that occur to me about this recording booth. One is that I'm almost sure there was such a thing, either on South Parade Pier or Clarence Pier Funfair when I was a kid. And you could just go in and do anything you want. You could talk, and it would record, and it would throw out a record that you could take home and play. The second thing to say is that was the first recording that Elvis Presley ever did. He went in something like that and cut something for his mum. Same sort of thing, where, of course, you don't get multiple copies. You get one copy. You can't be commercially recorded. And then I was saying to you earlier about the fact that it's also a significant part of that wonderful British gangster thriller, Brighton Rock, is that he's the Dickie Attenborough bad character, is persuaded by he marries a girl just to stop her giving evidence against him, and she persuades him to go and record a message in one of these for her. And he says something like, "You want me to say I love you, but I really don't love you, I really hate you," because he's a nasty piece of work. At the end of the film, he's died, and she takes it where she is and puts it on this record player. And it, like records do, and indeed like these records on the Neil Young thing do, it gets a click, it gets a scratch, and it doesn't keep playing. It goes click, click. And so he says, "You want me to say I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you." And so she smiles, you know, whereas she doesn't hear the rest of the story. So they have a kind of cultural role anyway. I quite like it. Some of the songs I like very much. One or two I don't like at all. My question about it is this. If he'd discovered one of these, a one-off record like this, and it had been genuinely recorded like that in 1947, and he'd put it out on vinyl, would we think that that was absolutely unquestionably authentic? It was somebody making it for his mother or his wife or whatever, and he only made one, but it happened to be very lovely. In this case, he's constructed all of that. So is this authentic, or is it in that classic postmodern sense merely the signifiers of authenticity? It's not actually authentic at all. He's just put all those signs of authenticity onto it. And that's one of my questions about it. I don't care about that, but I think it's important.
That's a really interesting question. A lot of people have thrown kind of hellfire at this, saying, well, why is Neil Young now kind of making this really old lo-fi record at the same time he's coming out with kind of you must listen to the purest digitalist form of music? Okay. And I say, you know, my take on this is that what he's trying to get to, what the thing he's pointing at, is that the relationship between the artist and the listener has become too complicated, and that people are losing a lot of the intention just because of all the kind of static that appears between these things. I think technically the record has a number of issues, and I think the flip side, the B side of the record, there are bits of harmonica and piano that really break up and really are quite difficult on the ears. But you've got to get over that. And the lovely thing about this record, the theme that he goes with, is it's a very personal compilation of songs that mean so much to him that he's passing on or trying to communicate to his parents who've long passed, and also to Ben Keith, who's one of his long-term collaborators. So there's a real nice personal message. And I think he's just done it because, you know, he's able to, he's got that space. But he's done it to kind of challenge, I think, some people's assumptions of the things that he does. He's done this before, I have to say. He's made a couple of records, probably sort of mid to late 80s. He made a record called Trans, where he used the vocoder for a lot of the audio, which was a crazy record, but actually it grows on you. He made another record called Everybody's Rocking, where he was that Geffen at the time demanded, the Geffen record label demanded that he make a rock and roll record. So he went down the Bill Haley route. And it's a fantastic record because it is just a satire of the record industry that, to be honest, you know, they had coming, as it were. So
I was interested in the choice of material because it slightly surprised me. In as much as a lot of guys of that generation, which is effectively my generation, Bob Dylan has done these albums. You know, he's done whole albums of roots music. But his roots stuff is 20s, 30s, hillbilly, blues, you know, he does stuff like Sporting Life. Neil Young hasn't quite done that. What Neil Young has done is to go to a lot of songs from the 60s by people like Tim Hardin and Bert Jansch, who were writing songs that came out of a Gordon Lightfoot, two Gordon Lightfoots, two Willie Nelson songs. They were writing songs that came out of those roots alongside Bob Dylan, rather than the roots themselves. So I'm intrigued, you know, that if you could read my mind by Gordon Lightfoot, is almost a kind of light poppy country song, really. It's not, he's not covering Bob Wills or Hank Williams, or, you know, because it's more country than bluesy, this. There is an Ivory Joe Hunter song on it. So I'm slightly intrigued by the song choices, but that again might be a generational thing, because for me, some of this is kind of mainstream pop. Given a kind of older, authentic sound. But if you're not as ancient as I am, then it may not seem like that. It's just that when I hear the Gordon Lightfoot songs... Oh, yeah, Early Morning Rain is the other one, you know. Yeah. Standing on the... the songs are also quite sentimental, which I think is a characteristic of Neil Young. I think he's quite a romantic, isn't he? But some of them... I mean, I love Changes by Phil Ox. Phil Ox was the real protest singer, if you like, alongside Bob Dylan, who was the popular protest singer. And Ox never strayed from his political convictions, but it's a beautiful song. And the Bert Jansch song from the English folk revival, but a song written in the 60s called Needle of Death, which is about drug addiction. Brilliant. Absolutely beautiful.
Well, we're going to play a snippet of Neil Young's version of that Bert Jansch song. So listen to this, persevere. See what you think. You're listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, and Dave Allen. Now, recently, I caught up with Janet Ayres to catch up with her to talk about all the kind of musical things she's up to, and also to get her take on the vinyl versus digital war. So, Janet Ayres, welcome back to Towards the Point.
Thank you.
You visited us before.
Yes.
We were talking about shanties last time, I think.
Yeah, we were.
It was nearly a year ago, unbelievably.
Really?
I know. But we're talking now about your wider musical portfolio. It's a grand term.
Yes, it is.
What are you up to these days? What are you branching into?
Well, the main bulk of my work started doing a community choir, which is now in its seventh year.
Wow.
And I started that, and there was just about eight people at the group. And that was really my first foray into what perhaps I didn't even realise was community music. But I'd been to various choirs, and I'd been and had some training done with the Natural Voice Network. So I have a lot of music background, played the violin at school, did all the associated board exams, which I never enjoyed.
All the serious stuff.
Yeah. And as somebody that I've read recently in a book says, when you get your grade eight, you're sort of all dressed up, nowhere to go, really. You either go in and become a member of an orchestra, or if you're very good, become a virtuoso, or nothing, or perhaps teach. So, and then carry on that same formal training.
So your choir now started from seven or eight people. How many kind of...
Well, there's about 50, I suppose.
Wow.
50, 60 on a crazy evening. The concert we did last weekend at St Jude's for Naomi House, we had about... we had about 40 or 50 in the choir, I think. So that was really good fun. So it's nice how things have evolved and changed. The thing that always has stayed the same is that with the choir that I run, I'm always there to get the group of people who are there, who turn up that night, to learn something more about their voice, learn some new songs, and enjoy singing, basically. So that seems quite a simple way of approaching things, but it works, and it works for lots of different things. So it works if you're doing a concert as well. So from there, I was doing the choir. A friend of mine was involved with getting some funding from the NHS, and I came up with the idea of doing Singing for Health. So I set up a small group, Portsmouth Voices. We got some funding to do free Singing for Health groups. They were so successful that we got some more funding to do that. And off the back of that, I've been able to do other things. So the other group that Portsmouth Voices run now is Beating the Blues, and that's a Wednesday morning, and that's just for anyone to come and sing. And it has taken it back to, it's like the old sing song around the piano, except there isn't any piano.
Oh,
that's a shame.
It is.
You don't want to hear my piano playing. But I think there's an awful lot of there's a lot of songs that people know from popular culture from the last how many years, 100 years maybe, and they are now, they're folk songs really. the ones that are good, the ones that have lasted, the ones that people can recall. So we do those, and we do lots of other songs from different traditions as well. So it's good fun. So the choir's still going strong. We do quite a few performances. I now do some other singing work with the Alzheimer's Society. I do a singing group with Parks, which is the Portsmouth Abuse and Rape Counselling Service. And they also got some money to do some singing for parents and babies, which is what something I used to do a long time ago before I'd started doing the choir. So lots of She'll Be Coming Round the Mountain.
Back to your roots, as it were.
All those sort of things. So
you've touched on this already, and it's a really interesting distinction that I want to try and explore with you. There's this kind of distinction between sort of formal music and formal music education, and then this split between kind of community music and the kind of, I suppose, more organic, and the word authentic is key here. There's that growing distinction, but there are other bits to it as well.
Yeah. I think because I'm also on the board of Sound Sense, which is a community music organisation which has been around for quite a long time. Gareth Malone has had connections with that. He used to be on that many years ago. And there are two different things, and some people think, well those two things do exist independently, formal music and community music, and there's often a crossover.
Mm.
And you see different things where perhaps people have a formal music training end up doing some music therapy, but they've not necessarily done any qualifications in music therapy per se. And then it might be someone from a community background that has no actual qualification in music who does end up teaching a formal music training. So, but I think where a lot of people, most people are in the community music, if you're talking about someone that you might bump into walking down the street, they'll say they're not musical, they can't sing. But actually, we all are very musical. If you can clap, hit something, that's music, you know.
I guess it's a bit like, there's a parallel in some ways to the kind of sport world, isn't there? You know, where kind of it's this question about, you know, can you learn to be a professional footballer, or do you need that extra spark and a talent? You know, you can put in as much, you know, commitment and time, those kind of things. But, you know, what's your take on that? Is it, you know, everyone, as you said, has got musical element and has potentially got rhythm.
Yeah.
But, you know, how different is it for the professionals,
well,
for the successful people?
Exactly. So it's what do you want to do with it?
Mm.
Does it matter if you want to become professional at something, then you do need to do other things.
Mm.
But so the flip side of that is, well, if I have no experience in it, I'm probably no good at it. Whereas music is about, it's actually a way of, this is the book I'm reading at the moment, is Life Music by Rod Paton. And he talks about music, it connects people to time. So it's definitely about where you are now. And there's a great thing about music making and singing with other people, which basically does connect you with now. It connects you with who you are. So it's not just who you are as in the job you do or the job you haven't got, the status you have, money, where you live. You sort of connect with yourself again and connect with a group of other people. So we are all musical in that sense, and it's having an experience and having opportunities that we will always do that. And so it's therapeutic with a small t.
So it's kind of, from what you said, there's an existential element to it, isn't there? You know, it's kind of, and potentially spiritual, you know, depending on your kind of...
not everyone can put their finger on, but a lot of people say, oh, they really enjoy it. And that's the nice thing as well. Everyone will have a completely different take on it, but it still works, even though everyone is coming from different places and wanting different things. There's something about, it's a bit of a leveller, really, to bring lots of people together. So, I mean, yes, I had quite a good experience. My music education was outside of mainstream. It was funded by the local authority.
God bless them.
I know. And it was the London Borough I grew up in. All my violin lessons were done by them and the orchestras I went to on a Saturday morning. So I don't even think I would have got involved with it if it had been in school. There's something quite nice about it. I always felt like slightly independent away from school. So that's why I did all of my training. But never then did I think I'd be running a choir. I think I always thought you have to be really good at the piano or something to do that. So for myself, it's been a really nice journey to sort of find myself running quite a successful choir without what I would have perceived as the qualifications I needed. The things that I've learnt about music have helped me, but it's not you know, it's, you don't have to have those things per se.
And this links very nicely to some of the things we've been talking about already in the show around Neil Young's new record, yep. A Letter Home, which, as I've said already, is kind of really for me is about trying to re-establish that relationship between the listener and the artist. And, you know, there's been a lot of criticism about the kind of arcane mechanics of it. But for me, it's magical. What was your take on it? You've had a bit of a listen.
I found it really moving. I found it, and just even right from the beginning when you're sort of listening and you're thinking, what's happening now? And he starts talking. And I knew what it was about. But there's still this feeling that you're having to sort of... And where is it from? It's got that quality of, did he record it last week? Or it also sounds like he recorded it 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Or are we listening to something that's been around the universe a few times and that this is something that someone recorded on another planet? And then when he's talking to his parents, I've found that really moving because obviously he can't talk to them. So, and I think that immediacy, and because that addresses something that perhaps we don't really think about. So I think there were lots of things going on for that. And then his performance I thought was great. I think we're quite spoilt with our ears. People are very critical, which is fine for people to be so in tune to all these different things. But I think that sort of rawness, it, you know, you could get someone saying, oh, well, should we just polish that bit and get that bit out? But I think it's definitely that thing of recording. So it was very much about recording that one piece of time because he just did it all in one take. And there might be people going, well, did he?
And have you yourself, you know, in terms of the musical things that you've been involved in, have you yourself dabbled with these kind of different techniques and different styles of recording, or are you sort of...
Well, we do the trio that I'm in, the Dave Baker Project, the album that we recorded, we did most everything all together, just recorded in one room, in one take. So, but because we play live, we sort of, that's what we do. We have to get it right.
Yeah.
And even if it's not quite going according to plan, sometimes that's when those nice accidents happen.
Well, let's talk about that trio, the Dave Baker Project. Yeah. Dave Baker is internationally famous, I think, now as a T-chest bass player.
Yes.
If you haven't seen him out and about, then... Where have you been, I think, is the question. But how did this trio come about? Did it grow out of ukulele things?
It did, really. I mean, I've been running the choir for a while, and one of the things I was doing was the Saturday Big Sing, and Dave came along to that about 3 years ago. He'd always said he'd always wanted to try singing, and he turned up, and he said he felt like he was in the Women's Institute because he couldn't see many other men singing. And I said, well, come along on a Tuesday.
A place he'd always wanted to be, no doubt.
Well, I know this is it. I mean, he said he was unsure, but anyway. So he started doing that, and then he went on to ukulele, and then he decided to have a go at the T-chest bass, and it just worked. And then he made his own T-chest bass. And then myself and Matt were thinking about trying some... jazz standards, that sort of thing. So we just asked Dave if he wanted to sort of have a bit of a practice, and it just worked straight away.
Tell me about some of the tracks that are on the record. What kind of things have you picked out to cover? They are all covers, more or
less.
They're
all covers, yeah. And some of them are quite... I think there was a thing, I don't know if we mentioned this last time, but on the radio earlier on in the year, on Radio 4, they were talking about the 20th century is now... It's like one musical movement. At the end of the 20th century, we were quite obsessed with decades. I worked for music sales and music publishers in the 90s, producing all the rock and pop list books and stuff like that. So we were quite obsessed with decades, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. Whereas now we're in the next century, it's sort of all one, and there's a bit of pick and... And you can see that reflected in music today. There's elements of things that are, well, it doesn't matter if that's from 1930s or 1950s. So there's things like the flat foot flugey. That's probably 1930s.
I'm glad you said that.
Yes, I have to think before I say that one. I've Got Rhythm, Pennies from Heaven. So there's some standards there. Busy Line. And I have to say, a lot of these we do hear from our... I guess she's probably a sister station, Angel Radio.
We can mention her.
Up near the, over Havant Way.
Up north. Yeah.
And they play everything. They don't play anything past 1956, I think. So we hear all these great songs, very simple, very simply done, vocal, piano, bass, drums, and they just seem to work.
And one of the tracks, I think you mentioned to me before, there's a kind of guitarist beamed in from a faraway shore.
Yes. A Guy What Takes His Time is Mae West's song. Usually when we're live, when we're playing for a gig or something, I might play on a kazoo or something. But I think on a recording, you might not want a kazoo.
No. does tend to break up somewhat.
It does. I think that is one case in point where live works. Certain things work. And also I have a lot of percussion that I play when we're live, and a lot of it is the theatricality of me doing that and will I get it right, which doesn't always come across once you've recorded it on a CD. You want to get everything right when you're recording. So I think just keeping it simple. So Matt's playing his ukulele, the drums at the same time with his feet, and then Dave on the bass and me singing means that there's not too many things that are going to go wrong.
You really sing on this, you know, you really use your voice on this. And yeah, I've heard you in choirs and ukulele groups and all those kind of different things. But on this, there's a real refinement, I think.
Yeah. Apparently it's a very good microphone.
That's what they all say. They say that in radio as well, I think. But, you know.
But I think we just, you know, the studio, Jim Young, where we recorded it, he did it all for us for nothing. He's got a lovely little setup there. So he just played probably for about 2 or 3 hours, just, you know, played song after song. And I think that's why I think we were kind of quite relaxed and it just sort of worked. So, it is really good fun. And we've been asked to do lots of different things, like stuff for a dance set and different parties and stuff. So quite busy this
summer.
Kind
of, are you touring as this band, as a trio sort of?
We are really. We have technically got a mini tour coming up where we're busking. We're doing the Gribble up near Oving, Chichester, for a dance night. We're playing at Music Bites in Havant on the 31st of May, and then we're playing at Whitstock, which is at Pond Barn and the Witterings. Mm-hmm. So we're doing quite a few parties and things. So, yeah.
And if folks want to find out more about the Dave Baker Project, where do they go? Where can they get their mitts on the CD?
We do have a Facebook page.
Okay.
So, the Dave Baker Project. So you find us on Facebook, contact us that way, and we will have another album coming out. It's going to be called Shipwrecked with the Dave Baker Project.
That already has a warm glow, I think, in my mind. Janet, it's been great to have you in again.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time. We're going to play out with one of your tracks. Which track are you going to choose for us?
I think it's got to be Busy Line.
A very good choice. Here it is, Busy Line by the Dave Baker Project.
Busy line. Called his uncle in Jamaica.
are listening to Towards the Point with me, James Sandy, and Dave Allen. And we move now into suits and boots and all those kind of things that Dave lovingly knows so much about, the mods, Dave. And a new book, The Mods, The New Religion, by Paul Smiler Anderson. Now, Smiler is a great tag, and I'm wondering, looking at you, whether you had a tag like that, a nickname?
I did, actually. In the 70s, when I was teaching, I used to wear Doc Martin shoes because they were just really comfortable for walking around and being on your feet all day. So the kids at Porchester School, this was in 1975 to 1980, used to call me Docker. They used to shout at me across the place. It was very embarrassing because I was a young teacher and they said, "Oi, Docker." It's kind of disappeared from my life since then. But
so
yes.
Your next book, Dave Docker Allen.
Yeah, could do. But if you see Paul, if you ever meet Paul, which I've done on a number of occasions, he is a smiler. I mean, there are lovely things to tell you about him. He's a second-generation mod in the sense that he came to mod at that age when it became very popular in 79-80 on the back of Quadrophenia. And there was a new bunch of bands at the time, and Paul Weller was spearheading that. He's called the Mod Father, which for people in my generation in the 60s just seems very odd, really. He seems like the mod baby to me, but, you know. And the styles actually are quite different in a lot of cases. But Paul Smiler Anderson, who's put this book together, is completely respectful of all the generations of mods, really. And what he's done here is very specifically a book about the mods that we, you know, those of us that grew up in the 60s and threw ourselves fairly wholeheartedly into that whole scene. Now, he's from Reading. And so one of the things he said was that, well, the mod scene has actually been very well documented already by all kinds of people. There are lots of books, some of them quite theoretical, some of them quite pictorial and so on. But they almost all revolve and almost exclusively revolve around London. And there's no doubt at all that London was the heart of the British mod scene, you know, through the 60s. But Paul was very well aware of the fact that it went on elsewhere. So what he's done in this book is to set out, it's a kind of oral history, really, where he's interviewed people. And he found out about the work I'd done on Pompey Pot and the blog and so on and got in touch with me. And he said he was coming to Portsmouth because he was going over to the Isle of Wight as a DJ on one of the scooter weekends. Could we meet up? So we met up in a pub on the Hard, you know, down by the dockyard, the first time I ever met him.
Ah, the Docker connection again. And there, the Docker, yeah.
Yes. And what I did was to pull together a few people from Portsmouth who'd been involved in the mod scene, very particularly in a club called the Birdcage Club, and pulled them together around at my house. And Paul came down from Reading with a mate of his, and we had some lunch, and they just talked all one Sunday afternoon, and they brought lots of memorabilia with them, and Paul looked at this, took photographs and so on. And he kept doing that all around the country. One of the things that really fascinated me was that when I was a kid, for family reasons, we used to have holidays in Chesterfield in Derbyshire. Had an aunt who lived there. And I opened the book, and he's got to Chesterfield, and he's found people in Chesterfield and Sheffield who were on the mod scene. He's got pictures of them and reminiscencing and so on. And he was really determined to say that actually in the 60s, the mods were not just Ready, Steady, Go, London, they were all those things, but that they were spreading out across the country.
It's taken quite a regional approach to kind of the movement, as it were.
It's really, and it's, I mean, I'm thrilled by it, really. I think it was a very exciting thing to be involved in. And we went to, there was a group, about half a dozen of us, who went to the launch at the Fred Perry store in Covent Garden. And we took with us my wife's best pal, really, Scylla Gilmore. And entirely by chance, Scylla was dancing on stage. I don't mean as a dancer, I just mean the audience used to get on the stage at the Birdcage when Jimmy James and the Vagabonds were there, because they were a really popular soul band. And she was dancing away, and somebody took a photograph, which then appeared on the front cover of the Jimmy James and the Vagabonds New Religion LP. And New Religion is the title that Paul has taken for his book. So there's a big reproduction of that picture with Scylla, who still lives in Southsea, you know, some years later, of course. This was 1966, I think. Big reproduction of it in the book. So we took Scylla as one, you know, in the group. She talks to Paul anyway, but we took her to London to the Fred Perry store. And we get there for the launch, and we're all dressed up. We're really seriously togged up. I mean, I went there with a, you know, neat jacket and trousers on and so on, and a tie. And I had a pocket handkerchief, which was polka dot, blue polka dot, white polka dot.
Similar but to what you wear for recording the show.
Yes, but I didn't have a tie to match it. So I spent the afternoon walking around Covent Garden stores trying to find a tie to match it, because I couldn't wear a tie that didn't match it, because mods wouldn't do that. And I found one. You know, it was like 40 quid for a tie, which is not something I'd normally do, because I don't wear ties very often.
But for the occasion.
So it was just fantastic to be able to turn up with a matching, and that's the sort of thing that, that as a mod, that you were pretty serious about those kinds of things. We took Scylla with us, and when we get there, Jimmy James and two members of the band, the Vagabonds, are there. So from 1966, and being who I am, I kind of go over to Jimmy. I say, "Hello, Jimmy. My name's Dave. I'm from the Birdcage." He gets excited about that. From Portsmouth, the Birdcage. He remembers it because they played there loads of time. And I said, "Yeah, but don't really matter about that. What I want to tell you is that Scylla from the front cover of your album is here, and she's over there." And he was just so excited about it. It was, and so we took photographs with the three of them together again, and it was just.
And
lovely.
Is there a story about her not really meaning to be there, or she shouldn't have been there? Perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to say about the Birdcage is it did have a bit of a reputation, because of course one of the things that one has to acknowledge about the mods is that it was in a sense probably the first of the kind of youth movements that did have attached to it some kind of connotations of drug taking. Now not all mods took drugs by any means, but there was a lot of amphetamine taken, a lot of pill taken, a lot of staying up all night and so on, and I'm pretty sure that Scylla was not one of those people, because she was about a 14 or 15 year old schoolgirl, but her parents were pretty, you know, straightforward, and I think her dad was a headmaster. And she was not to go to the Birdcage. And the teachers at the school, you know, it was not a place that you would go to. So not only does she end up on the front cover of the album, which is fairly safe because they're not going to go and see that, but the story gets in the local paper. And she's, you know, just in a panic. I mean, nowadays it's a great story. And nobody found out. Fortunately, she got away with it. And she, you know, because what they used to do was to say, "I'm going out tonight to stay with my friend Lynn." And Lynn would say, "I'm going out to stay with my friend Scylla," you know, and they'd both go down the Birdcage. Yeah. My folks were fine about it, which was interesting because they were also extremely straight, ordinary people. But I live near Devonshire Square, and the Birdcage Club, for most of its life, the Birdcage Club was in Eastleigh by Brandsbury Park. And it did become absolutely legendary, you know. I mean, The Who played there, The Small Faces, Little Richard, Wilson Pickett, Cream, Pink Floyd even, you know, in its late days, going towards psychedelia. And The Drifters and so, you know, I mean, it was just stunning. And it was three or four nights a week, and wonderful, wonderful experience. And there is a feature on the Birdcage in the book. There's quite a lot about Portsmouth in the book, and there is a feature.
It's a beautifully designed book, and it's quite beautiful. You know, it's got some great pictures and all kinds of different things. I think one thing that struck me in just having, you know, sort of flicked through it briefly is that it's not just about the music scene. It's very much about the style and the dress and the lifestyle and the wear. You know, you described you running around Covent Garden trying to find the right tie.
Yeah.
A real, you know, the title New Religion fits well, because there is a ritual to all of
question, and you could be more or less in. And I was always hanging on the coattails of the more stylish mods, not least because I was always I stayed at school longer than some people. People could leave school at 15 then, and a lot of the mods, including one or two of my great friends, Ted and Jim, are both in the book, left school then, got apprenticeships, were therefore earning a wage, would save the money, would buy. They'd go to London and buy full-length leather coats. And we used to have suits made, you see. You never bought a suit off the peg. And some of those scenes that you see in Quadrophenia are quite true, where you're in the tailors and you're having an argument about how long the vent's going to be or how wide the trousers are going to be. Or those things were really quite serious. And when you wore what you wore, so you go out in the evening, you'd wear a suit. My dad's best friend had a Gents Outfitters in Elm Grove, and it was an old-fashioned Gents Outfitters, Percy Brookman his name was, where I used to buy shirts that had detachable collars, and I would wear these pale blue double-striped shirts, but the stripes were really subtle, and then I would have a stud collar separate, a white collar into that, and then a paisley tie, and you know, and yet in the day you'd go out with jumbo cord trousers, a camel reefer jacket, desert boots, red socks, you know, it would be different kind of casual wear. But you're right about that. I mean, you know, if we think about it briefly, there's no doubt that fashion is at the heart of the mod thing, but the music as well, soul and Tamla and so on. And I've mentioned before that last Saturday was the most recent time I was at the Dock Soul Club, and there is still this club in Portsmouth once a month at the Dockyard Club in Onslow Road, first Saturday of every month. And I, you know, I was dancing away on Saturday night to 60s soul and from Motown, which is a part of it. And then there, you know, there's other stuff like the relationship between soul and blues music, soul and ska. There's chapters on in the book about scooters, about the riots and the rockers, which was actually a very small part of the mod thing. It was really unimportant, you know. The TV show Ready Steady Go, dances, you know, being able to dance the best dances. I've never been a great dancer about that. Certainly the drug-taking thing, the clubs, which is where the Birdcage gets a focus. And then towards the end, he very wisely talks about the fact that for a lot of mods, there was a transitional phase into something that was not exactly hippie, but was certainly much longer-haired and much, you know, freer clothes-wise than early psychedelia and so on. And my pal Ted, who's in the book, always says, no, we weren't hippies. He says we were heads. We went from being mods to heads. But very rule-governed, very ritualistic, absolutely, you know, you were in or not, you know, and so on.
There's a lot of menswear kind of fashion sketches in the book, which I find fascinating, partly because my family has a bit of a legacy in menswear. Looking at me, you wouldn't think it, I know, but there's a lot about kind of hair and hats and posture.
Yeah,
posture's key. You know, some of the sketch images of men in suits, they wear those suits, you know. You often say, you either wear the suit or the suit wears you, don't they? You know, there's that kind of thing. There's some fantastic interviews as well in the book. I think Martha Reeves is in the book.
Yes, she is. Yeah.
Chris Farlow's in the book as well.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of archive material in terms of adverts and newspaper
posters clips and record and posters. Covers.
It's a real kind of a real treasure trove. Isn't
visually,
it?
Visually brilliant. There's some wonderful visual stuff.
A real archive. There's a key question I need to ask you, because a number of the bits I've read of the book and reading around it, everyone's talking about frothy coffee.
Oh, yeah.
So how important is frothy coffee to the mod scene?
Not terribly important, but it's just what you got. And it was a brand new element of that continental coffee bar thing, which actually, has to be said, predates the mod thing in terms of the beatnik skiffle scene to some extent, particularly in the West End of London. It was just that they suddenly had these machines that produced this kind of special coffee, which was, frankly, nothing much more than froth. My memory, for instance, of the Manhattan coffee bar in Palmerston Road is that they had these quite shallow glass cups and glass saucers, and you got frothy coffee. So, and you tried to make it last all night, which was pretty hard considering half of it was froth. But that was just, it wasn't vital really to that. Although, one thing I will say, I've talked about drugs, one thing I will say is that there was relatively little drinking. There was a pub next door to the Birdcage, and some people went in there, the Cumberland Tavern, Charlie Hurdles, it was known as affectionately. The Birdcage Club itself, and this was typical of quite a lot of clubs in those days, you know, it was dark and pop-arty and, you know, wild bands and people dancing and so on. But all that had in there was a bar that sold Coca-Cola and coffee. There was no drinking, and there was no drunkenness and no wildness of that kind at all.
It was the sugar keeping you going, wasn't
it? Yeah, probably the sugar, yeah.
So, coming back to the book, and you know, you've got a copy in front of you, and there are numerous tags sticking out of that book. So you've already delved deep into it. Do you think is it an assessment of the scene, or is it a celebration, or does it balance the two?
Yeah, I mean, there is a narrative that Smiler writes through it, which is pretty good, really, and it's somewhat analytical. But it is, I think, more celebratory, frankly. I mean, there have been some quite serious pieces of academic work. A guy called Dick Hebditch, for instance, who wrote quite a serious analysis of it, and another guy called Stan Cohen, who wrote about the Mods and Rockers riots, and he too pointed out that really, to a large extent, these were media constructs, you know, to create horror stories about people who weren't really that alarming. But I think this is more celebratory. But what it does do is provide a great deal of material that adds to, you know, the archives of materials about the 60s. And so much of the stuff about the 60s is written by so-called experts, you know, academics or media experts in London who want to tell you what went on. What's lovely about this is an ordinary bloke, he's a postman, this guy, Paul Anderson, an ordinary bloke in Reading has got hold of ordinary blokes around the country, like me and my mates, and said, tell us how it was. You know, and I think we've had that opportunity to do it, and that's a delightful thing to be able to do. Really.
It's a really genuine record of a passion, really, I guess.
I think it absolutely is that, yeah.
And there's a launch event coming up very soon.
There is in Portsmouth, which is lovely. I've only just learnt about it, but I'm really pleased. It's on Thursday, the 26th of June at Waterstones in Commercial Road. I don't quite know the time at the moment, but I guess it's going to be around 5 o'clock, something like that. Yeah, that'll be real fun, and I hope the place is absolutely packed out with, you know, people in smart suits and maybe even some people with parkas and scooters and things. Who knows what will happen?
Excellent. We'll put details of that event on our blog. Mods, The New Religion by Paul Smiler Anderson is available now on Omnibus Press, and it's available for around £20. Just before we go, we've just got time to catch up with a few events, local and wider. If you fancy a bit of Simon and Garfunkel, you can go and catch the Simon and Garfunkel story in Southsea at the King's Theatre on the 4th of June, direct, nonetheless, from London's West End.
And I wonder whether they will mention the fact that Paul Simon played in Portsmouth in folk clubs more than once in the 1960s. I bet they won't.
Only one way to find out.
I've got a general and a specific. My general is Portsmouth festivities, which are back again, 20th to 29th of June, and they are advertising music, theatre, dance, families and schools, art, literature, talks, outdoor and film. A 10-day festival celebrating arts, culture and heritage, and you can find out all about it at portsmouthfestivities.co.uk. And then specifically within the Portsmouth festivities, I think it's the launch night, if I'm not wrong, the Talis Scholars, War and Peace, on Friday the 20th of June. This is choral music of the most beautiful kind, really. The Talis Scholars are the world's leading performers of Renaissance sacred music. I absolutely love it. I'm looking forward to it. It's at the Cathedral, 7:30, Friday the 20th of June. And if you get in quick enough, you can even have a talk before it, and you can even have a meal before it, if you fancy such.
What a great night out that could be. If you fancy a bit of synth-based pop, quite frankly, we all do now and again, you can catch East India Youth playing at the Wedgwood Rooms on Thursday the 5th of June. And if that's not enough, up until the 18th of June at the Aspects Gallery, you can catch Ginny Topp's Remaining exhibition, which is about a number of things, but how she overcame illness, which is an interesting take on art. And it's in the cafe, spread across the cafe. So go and have a look at that until the 18th of June. Just before we go, I should mention our blog. All the things we've been talking about are on our blog, towardsthepoint.blogspot.com. Our thanks to Janet Ayres and to our good friends at Pie and Vinyl. My thanks to Dave Allen for strutting his stuff on the airwaves once more. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.